U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken returns to Israel for another ceasefire push.
Just hours after he landed, Hamas raised doubts about the mission, accusing Israel of undermining his efforts.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Chicago to accept her party's nomination for president later this week.
We will win. And we will win. And we will win.
And hunting Burmese pythons in the Florida Everglades.
We go deep in the swamp. We get up on the tree islands. We want to have those veterans' endorphins flowing to get those brains cycling back the right way.
Today is Monday, August 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Tel Aviv on Sunday to try to seal a ceasefire deal after months of negotiations between Israel and Hamas. But even as hopes for a ceasefire are high, implementing it could prove challenging. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the details.
The end of hostilities would be carried out in three phases, explains National Security Professor at the University of New Haven, Howard Stauffer. He spoke via Skype.
And the withdrawal process, even from Gaza, is complicated because Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has said that they want a restriction on armed individuals in southern Gaza from going into northern Gaza.
The implementation could prove tricky, Stauffer notes.
There may be differences of opinion about who may be released, and the withdrawal process even from Gaza is complicated because Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, has said that they want a restriction on armed individuals in southern Gaza from going into northern Gaza.
Blinken's visit comes amid heightened tensions. Iran could still avenge the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh last month in Tehran. Successful peace talks could calm the mood.
Then there's a very strong likelihood that Hezbollah on its own, or Iran and Hezbollah, will carry out their retaliatory strikes against Israel. If they do that, there will be a much greater widening of the war in the entire region.
The end of the hostilities would ensure the distribution of humanitarian aid in Gaza and allow for mass vaccinations against the rising threat of polio. The Palestinian health minister confirmed the first case Saturday. Some Palestinian mothers worry. Ilham Nasser's son suffers from a skin disease. She says vaccines against polio, medicine, and proper sanitation are needed. She wonders how long it will take for them to get help and warns that children could die or become paralyzed.
We need a vaccine for it. We need medicine. We need proper sanitation. We want you to save us before it's too late. Or how long are we supposed to wait? Should we wait until we watch our children die and become paralyzed and then become helpless to do anything for them?
In Israel, relatives of the hostages held by Hamas express cautious optimism about the prospects of a ceasefire and the release of their loved ones.
We learned from past experience that not to build the expectation too much, because then if it doesn't complete to a deal, the disappointment is so huge, and you go down so far that it's very hard to rise up again. But we still try to stay optimistic and hope.
Even as the ceasefire negotiations mediated by the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt are set to reconvene in Cairo this week, Israeli military operations haven't ceased. On Sunday, Palestinian authorities reported at least 28 people were killed in overnight strikes across Gaza. The Israeli military said it killed 20 militants in attacks Saturday night into Sunday. On the eve of his expected meeting with Blinken, Benjamin Netanyahu led a weekly cabinet meeting Sunday in which he criticized Hamas's approach to the peace talks and reiterated his stance that, quote, strong military and diplomatic pressure are the way to secure the release of the Israeli hostages. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris landed in Chicago Sunday for the Democratic National Convention, where she will accept her party's nomination for president later this week. Outside the convention center, there will be protesters demonstrating against one of her thorniest electoral issues, the Biden administration's aid to Israel. A coalition of about 200 organizations say they will march to make their voices heard. But what else will Harris face as she takes control of the Democratic Party? Joining us now to talk about that is John Mark Hansen, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us to do this.
My pleasure.
So, Vice President Harris goes to the convention. She assumes control of the party, in essence. What does she have to do this week at the convention?
She needs to do what nominees will typically do, which is to get the party excited about her prospects in the fall and get them really behind her and ready to work for her. She's had quite a lead up to this convention, and so in a lot of ways she needs to kind of simply put the finishing touches on her debut.
She has generated an enormous amount of excitement in all metrics. Outpouring of support in terms of new volunteers, new money, big crowds, positive reviews. She benefits from a short runway, right?
Yeah. This is very clearly a honeymoon, one might anticipate that there might be tougher sailing ahead. But anytime there's a kind of, you know, new face on the stage, there's an awful lot of public interest and a lot of public enthusiasm for that person. And particularly under these circumstances, where I think many Democrats were feeling discouraged and kind of ready to simply surrender and give up, it's really kind of given hope, I think, to people in the party and people who lean toward the party that a Trump presidency is not inevitable.
You know, she still has to overcome some of the baggage that is being brought forward. One of the things that I saw was there were about 200 groups who intend to gather in Chicago to protest the Biden administration's support of Israel. That's a balancing act for her, no?
Well, yes, it's a balancing act for her, but the advantage she has relative to President Biden is that she's not President Biden, and my sense is that it's at least possible that the changeover to a new candidate has kind of taken some of the edge off. It was very, very personalized, I think, with President Biden, and Vice President Harris, I think, is just sort of less personally involved in it. And there's the opportunity, I think, as well to kind of benefit from people, you know, waiting to see exactly how she's going to come down on the issue. And then in a new competitive matchup where it will be clear that the choice is not between President Biden and the perfect person from whoever's standpoint, the choice is between Vice President Harris and Donald Trump.
Right. This is going to be the first time when she gets up and speaks. She's been vice president. She's been a senator, no doubt, attorney general of California. But for most of the country, this is when she gets up and speaks and accepts the nomination, it's really going to be the first time people see her in this way. What does she have to do in that speech?
Well, again, I think that she's had a lot of practice, actually, over the last several weeks. And she's taken to the stage more naturally than I might have expected her to, given the disappointment of her very brief presidential run in 2020. I think what she needs to do is to just kind of stay the course that she's been on for the last several weeks. Not only are there a lot of people who may be meeting her for the first time, but they're also meeting her with a set of hopes and expectations that – that they'll come away impressed. And so, you know, she's going to be speaking to an audience that's already pretty receptive to her. And I think kind of rewarding them with the kind of feel-good experience that she's been rewarding the audiences that she's drawn so far is pretty much what she needs to go with.
All right. Thank you so much for the time and the perspective.
You bet.
John Mark Hansen, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. To put a finer point on the expected protests in Chicago at this week's Democratic Convention, it won't be the first convention to have protest. It's a tradition in the U.S., as old as the modern political convention itself. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti takes a look at some of the volatile confrontations from past conventions.
Chicago, 1968. Violence outside the Democratic National Convention between police and Vietnam War protesters. TV, still a relatively new medium, showing the conflicts live. New York City, 1976. The last time the Democratic Party would announce its vice presidential candidate at the convention, with presidential candidate Jimmy Carter choosing Walter Mondale.
We have that vision. We love our country, and we're going to do our job. Thank you very much.
Chaos at the next convention in 1980, when Senator Ted Kennedy challenged President Carter's re-election. Kennedy would concede to Carter in a famous speech that ended with this line.
The cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
Back to Chicago, 1996, and... Civil rights protesters demanding racial equality and welfare reform. Police keeping the crowds from entering the security perimeter. Denver, 2008. Barack Obama's acceptance speech moved to an outdoor stadium to accommodate the convention record crowd of 84,000.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
This week in Chicago, Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz begin their party's convention with some momentum. Last month, President Joe Biden was trailing Republican candidate Donald Trump in political polls. Since Biden dropped out, candidate Harris has risen in those polls. Last week's morning consult survey showing her 3 points ahead of Trump, although it remains a tight race. There will be protesters, as there always are at conventions, like these from last month's Republican gathering held in neighboring Wisconsin. Meeting them in Chicago will be thousands of federal, state, and local police officers. Derek Mayer is the U.S. Secret Service Deputy Special Agent in charge for the Democratic Convention.
I'm confident that our plan will provide a safe and secure environment during the DNC.
Chicago officials expect as many as 50,000 out-of-town visitors for the convention, with the city's United Center hosting the Democratic Party events. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Hundreds of Portuguese firefighters on Sunday scrambled to put out a wildfire sweeping parts of the island of Madeira. The island's south coast is popular with tourists. Strong winds are complicating the efforts to tackle the fire. Petongtan Shinawat became Thailand's prime minister after receiving a royal letter of endorsement Sunday. She's the daughter of the divisive former leader, Thaksin Shinawat. Venezuelans across the world responded to a call from their country's political opposition. They've taken to the streets to defend the faction's claim to victory over President Nicolas Maduro last month in the disputed presidential election. The demonstrations in Caracas, Tokyo, Sydney, Mexico City, Miami, and several other cities were an effort by the main opposition coalition to make visible what they insist is the real outcome of the election. South Korea and the United States kicked off annual summertime military exercises on Monday, looking to boost their joint readiness to fend off North Korea's weapons and cyber threats. Russia struck Kyiv with ballistic missiles, officials in the capital said, as Ukraine continued its incursion into Kursk. Moscow denied reports that the invasion, the biggest in Russian history since World War II, had derailed any indirect talks with Kyiv. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder tells us why.
Russia carried out its third ballistic missile attack on Kyiv this month, but most of them were apparently shot down on approach, the city's military administration said on Sunday. Residents in the Ukrainian capital were inspecting the crater caused by what's believed to be a North Korean missile. Kyiv officials said there were no immediate reports of casualties in the capital. Russia and Ukraine accuse each other of striking civilian infrastructure in the war, and both deny doing so. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Saturday his troops had strengthened positions in Russia's Kursk region, nearly 2 weeks into their incursion. He called for bold decisions by Kyiv's allies to allow long-range strikes. These Ukrainian soldiers are conducting drills across the border from Kursk, where Ukraine says it has seized more than 80 settlements over 444 square miles. It's the biggest invasion of Russia since World War II. Against the backdrop of that incursion, Belarus's president, a staunch ally of Russia's Vladimir Putin, spoke of a tense standoff along his country's border with Ukraine on Sunday. President Alexander Lukashenko said Ukraine had stationed more than 120,000 troops along that border, and Minsk had deployed nearly a third of its armed forces there. Russia denied a report that Ukraine's Kursk attack had derailed indirect talks with Kyiv on halting strikes on energy and power targets. A spokesperson for the foreign ministry denied those talks had been going on, saying no one broke anything off because there was nothing to break off. She was responding to a report in the Washington Post on Saturday that Ukraine and Russia were planning to send delegations to Qatar this month to negotiate a landmark agreement on halting strikes on critical civilian infrastructure.
Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Street protests in India as some junior doctors remained off the job on Sunday demanding swift justice for a colleague who was raped and murdered. Doctors across the country have held protests, candlelight marches, and refused to see non-emergency patients in the past week after the killing of the 31-year-old postgraduate student in the early hours of August 9th. Some of the protesters say they were roughed up by the police.
I am a citizen of India. As a citizen of India, I am protesting against this heinous crime. It is happening everywhere, all across, but mostly in West Bengal. Because it is, and we don't feel safe in our own place. How we are being beaten by the police today? I was holding the placard. We were beaten by the police. It is not acceptable. We want justice.
Women activists say the incident at the British colonial era R.G. Carr Medical College and Hospital has highlighted how women in India continue to suffer despite tougher laws following the gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old student on a moving bus in Delhi in 2012. Health officials say Sudan has been hit by a cholera outbreak that has killed nearly two dozen people and sickened hundreds more in recent weeks. The World Health Organization said 78 deaths were recorded from cholera this year in Sudan. The disease also has sickened more than 2,400 others. Also from Sudan, UN aid agencies are welcoming the opening of the Adre border crossing with Chad, which they say will allow desperately needed humanitarian assistance to flow to millions of people who've been trapped in Sudan's conflict hotspot for months, with limited access to food and medicine and other essential relief. More now from Lisa Schlein.
The decision by Sudan's armed forces to reopen the Adre border crossing comes as aid agencies race to save the lives of millions of people at risk of starvation and deadly disease outbreaks. The World Food Program calls Sudan the world's largest hunger crisis. The agency says the opening of the border crossing will enable aid to be delivered into Darfur, where intense fighting is occurring. Speaking from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, WFP Sudan spokesperson Lenny Kinsley says her agency plans to deliver aid to the Zamzam displaced persons camp near El Fasher, North Darfur's capital, where famine was declared 2 weeks ago.
WFP is immediately mobilizing vital food and nutrition supplies to be transported across the Adri corridor over the coming weeks. We need to see trucks moving across this border every single day to get a consistent flow of aid into the region and to urgently save lives.
Kinsley says nearly 6,000 metric tons of food and nutrition supplies for around 500,000 people are being loaded and will be ready to go as soon as the Sudan government gives the green light. She adds WFP also is scaling up assistance to 13 other areas on the brink of famine. And she says WFP aims to reach 8.4 million people by the end of the year. At the same time, the World Health Organization is embracing the opening of the Adre crossing. WHO spokesperson Dr. Margaret Harris says millions of Sudanese have lacked access to health care, food, and other basic relief for months because of insecurity. She says people who are malnourished or starving are at risk of serious health consequences.
Anything that's a mild infection in somebody with good nutrition, a good immune system, becomes a catastrophic illness in somebody who's malnourished, particularly a child. And they can die very, very quickly from what might be a minor infection if they are malnourished.
The decision by the Sudanese government to open the Adre crossing followed the start of U.S.-sponsored peace talks in Geneva. While diplomats have said little publicly about how the talks are progressing, on Thursday, Tom Perriello, the U.S. Special Envoy on Sudan, also welcomed the opening of the Adre crossing. In a social media post Thursday, Perriello described the aim of the talks.
I'm here in Switzerland with diplomatic partners, and we're urgently working to produce some breakthroughs on humanitarian access and cessation of hostilities in compliance with the earlier Jeddah agreements and international humanitarian law. With over 25 million Sudanese affected by acute hunger, starvation, shelling of homes, and forced displacement, we are way past the moment of urgency for the international community to do more. We are eager to be able to also do mediated talks with the RSF and the SAF, and we hope that President Burhan will send a senior staff delegation so that we can extend that mediation effort. But we aren't waiting.
A delegation from the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, is present in Geneva. The head of the Sudanese Armed Forces, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, so far has not sent a delegation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally,
look at that.
This week, the annual Python Challenge is being held in Florida's Everglades. It's hosted by the Wildlife Commission to incentivize people who track down invasive Burmese pythons that thrive in Florida's preserved wetlands.
Python, it's definitely one of the hardest animals I've ever had, you know, to do, because it's really a matter of right time and right place. There is no, like, setting out a trap or sent to, you know, attract them. There's none of that.
Florida's been paying about 100 contractors year-round to round up the pythons in a project shared by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and the South Florida Water Management District. Through 2023, more than 18,000 pythons have been removed from the wild. Florida prohibits hunters from using firearms to kill pythons, and they aren't venomous, so capturing them is very much a hands-on experience.
We go deep in the swamp, we get up on the tree islands.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. You can also download the VOA app from Apple and Google. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.